This week on C-SPAN's Afterwards podcast, writer Marie Arana shares stories and little-known histories of the diverse Latino population of America, the fastest-growing minority in the U.S. She's interviewed by American University's Center for Latin American and Latino Studies director, Ernesto Castaneda.
Since March 19, 1979, C-SPAN, a public service funded by the cable television industry, began giving you direct access to government in an innovative way by putting you, the viewer, into the rooms where politics is debated and policies are determined. C-SPAN began as a bold initiative. Now, 45 years later, we are essential for those wanting to see democracy at work, without editing or commentary. With continued cable support, we've done this without a dime of government funding, maintaining our independence. As we mark 45 years, the business of media is rapidly changing, and now your support is crucial for our mission's future. Support our legacy of unfiltered access by donating today at cspan.org/donate. Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Today, we have the privilege of being joined by Marie Arana, the author of this new book, Latinoland, a portrait of America's largest and least understood minority. So it's a fantastic book that is just coming out with Simon & Schuster, and we're going to be discussing it today. It's a thick book, full of exciting stories, new information, overviews of the different Latino populations that live in the United States of America. So we're not going to be able to cover it all today, but I want to scratch the surface and ask some questions to the author about this fascinating new book. So first of all, congratulations, Marie, on this great endeavor, this great accomplishment. I have enjoyed very much reading the book. It's very accessible, very easy to read. Hard to stop reading, a page turner. So that by itself is a big accomplishment, because it also goes over a lot of history, demographics, facts, definitions in a way that it's very illuminating for scholars, students, and the general public.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Professor. It's such a pleasure to be in conversation with you. Thank you for doing this.
My pleasure, Marie. Thank you so much. And so my first question is, you explain very clearly in the book the fact that pilgrims came many, many decades before there were other people in what is now the United States of America that we would call today Latinos or Hispanics. So I wonder if, for the benefit of our audience, you can talk a little bit more about this history of the Latinos in this Latino land.
Absolutely, Professor. You know, I think so many Americans who are non-Latinos think that we are recent additions to this country, which is absolutely incorrect. The Latino people have been, first of all, the original inhabitants of this country. The indigenous Latinos, of course, were here long before they were called Latinos. And the history goes all the way back to really also include the Spanish conquest, of course, because the Spaniards, the conquistadores, were in Florida in 1535, and they were actually coming up in Mexico in at the turn of the century, from the 16th to the 17th century. So there is a long tradition, many hundreds of years before The Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock. So we have a history that goes really back 500 years for Hispanic Americans. That means a combination of Spanish and indigenous, and way before that, with the tribes that inhabited this continent before the America was even an idea.
Correct. And again, that's something that we often forget as a nation. Is something that, as you say, is rarely explained in textbooks and in schools. So one of the questions that arises from your work is, why would you say that despite this long history of Hispanics being in the USA, why, as you call it, why do Latinos remain unseen?
You know, that's a puzzlement to me. It's the reason why I wrote this book. I have now for two decades been trying to explain the history of Latinos. And I started with Latin American history because that's where we all come from. And it occurred to me that, you know, there are 64 million Latinos, Hispanics in this country, Latinx, whatever you want to call us. There are 64 million of us, which is larger than any Spanish-speaking country in this hemisphere, except for Mexico. It's an extraordinary amount of people, and yet our history is not taught in schools. There are very few general history textbooks or civil studies textbooks that explain who we are and explain that we were here long before the country was even formed. So that's been my mission for many years. And now when my editor said, well, you've written a lot about Latin America, how about the Latin America that is here? And I remember one ambassador said to me, you know, this is a country within a country, and it has been here a very long time. And it's about time that it was explained and taught in the schools. There's, it's odd, our invisibility. It's almost, I think the editor of the New York Times during the 60s and the 70s once said, this was Scotty Rustin, James Rustin, who said, and he was on the front of the Time magazine saying it, everybody loves Latin Americans, everybody loves Latinos, but nobody wants to read about them. And I'm trying to challenge that in this book. The stories are amazing. The stories are very rich and full of diversity in itself. So I'm hoping that finally we can get rid of Mr. Reston's judgment that nobody wants to read about us.
Absolutely, and that's why your book is so important, because it covers this gap, this absence in the learning of our own history, and it's important. Let me just comment real quick that this seems to be an ailment that affects U.S. Americans in general. I think the public in the U.S. is not his historian buffs in general. Buffs, we have a lot of people watching C-SPAN that probably do so, and they're more likely reading biographies of ex-presidents or, as you say in the book, these great men histories of biographies, generals, presidents, emperors, or histories about battles and wars, but less so the history of the people, and much less so ethnic histories, right? I don't think there's many popular books about the history of even Anglo-Saxons in the U.S. right after the independence, but much less so Scandinavians, Poles, Irish, Italians, and their ethnic histories throughout the U.S. Much of that is lost, or it keeps a regional focus, or it's work done very narrowly by historians. So again, your book has a historical comprehension, that it has a lot of depth, and it's looking at all of Latino groups throughout the United States. It's a great remedy for this issue that we have.
Thank you.
Among the diversity of the Latino people that you discuss, we have. I love your discussion about the indigenous question, the indigenous identity. So I wonder if you can please tell your audience a little bit about the importance of this indigenous history among many contemporary U.S. Latinos.
Absolutely. I think that what isn't realized, I think there's a sense, you know, even with the Manifest Destiny, when Americans were told to take their families and go west and just, you know, put a stake in the ground and spread America and spread America's borders, didn't realize, and I think even as they were doing it, they didn't realize that they were moving into a land that already belonged to the Spanish colonial system. The indigenous, of course, who inhabited that whole section, and we're talking about, a territory that begins in Mexico and goes all the way up to Wyoming and Colorado. And then west to east from California all the way to Kansas. And that land belonged by conquest to the Spanish. And so that was an invasion of sorts. And the invasion was to a tremendously diverse group of indigenous people. People who belong to the Nahua, the Mayans, the Apache, who were Spanish speaking, the Comanche also. So we have this tremendously rich culture of indigeneity. And then this tremendous culture that had begun in the 1500s when Cortes came to Mexico and conquered Mexico, of the mestizo population, which in itself was carried on the great indigenous traditions of cultivating the land, of being agronomists, astronomers. I mean, there was a very rich culture before the Spanish conquest, and certainly, before Manifest Destiny spread America all the way to the West Coast.
That is correct. So that's a long history, and you're right, part of the history is a history of imperial expansion, of war, of taking over territory. And again, that's something that you explained really well. You also delve into the relationship with Spain, and then the relationship with Puerto Rico, Central America, and everything that is also has to do with interventions abroad and international relations. You mentioned in the book, and you just mentioned a minute ago, the 64 million or plus people that can trace back their origins to Latin America and the Caribbean. And you say that very interestingly, that that is the second largest Spanish-speaking population is in the United States. But as you also say correctly, not all Latinos today speak Spanish. That's and also this nation within a nation of Latinos, it's so demographically in terms of numbers, but it is not. So I wonder if we can talk a little bit more about how the 64 million are so perfectly enmeshed into American culture, how they are in all different parts of the United States, and how they are so integrated, marrying other people from other backgrounds, that they can remain invisible, that they can, they are not claiming for independence, right? They are not claiming for secession. The opposite, they are kind of the Uber Americans. So I wonder if you can talk about that other side of the 64 million as a soft part of the U.S. and talk about their belonging, their embeddedness into the U.S. society.
Absolutely, absolutely, Professor. You know, I think part of the reason why the cohesion of Latinos has been so slow to actually happen is because the immigrants who have come here, of course, the Mexicans who have lived on that land for generations, all the way back to before the conquest even, who've stayed in this side of the border, have been here for time immemorial. But for the immigrants who came, there is this sense that you are a Boricua, a Puerto Rican, or you are, like me, a Peruvian American, or, you know, a Colombian American, or a Panamanian American. And then you learn, when you come here as an immigrant, that you are part of this body of Latinos, and you're called a Latino, you're called a Hispanic. It's for the first time that anybody realizes that they are part of this larger group. And the groups, of course, that come are very, very different, and they inhabit different parts of the country. The Cubans, of course, are in the southeast, in mainly in Florida, very much a presence in Miami. And the Puerto Ricans as well are in Florida. But the Puerto Ricans are in New York and New Jersey and all the way up to Maine and New Hampshire and the Dominican the Dominicans as well. You know, the Northeast is populated really with Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and smatterings of everybody else, because now the population is moving around depending on where the work is. So you have the Midwest finally. In Chicago, there's a very big body of Mexican Americans who have come up to work in the different industries. And the, of course, the Mexicans, who are 37 million of the 64 million, is a great preponderance of Mexican Americans in this country, and with a long history and a long sense of belonging, really, to the land, to the territory. And all of these, we have a new wave of Salvadorans from El Salvador, from the whole Northern Triangle, from Honduras and from Nicaragua, who have come up since the 1970s. And so they're very much a different group with different traditions and habits and rituals and different ethnic makeup. But and not all of us necessarily know one another. I mean, I have friends who are Mexican Americans who have never traveled east and have never really been in a Dominican context, really. So it's hard sometimes to feel like you belong to any group that is outside your own. However, and Junot Diaz, the novelist, Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, who is a Dominican, said, "You criticize any one of us, and we all are Latinos, and we all sort of coagulate and defend the tribe."
Yes. Also, in your book, you talk about the people with no name. And you have a couple of beautiful quotes illustrating these. And this eternal question, right, about what to be called, whether Hispanic, as Nixon did through the Census Bureau, an imposition of a label that caught up and is still very vibrant in Texas and other parts of the country. Latinos, which is, as you say, relevant to the Latin American idea that the French had to take control colonially of to conquer some of the land that the Spanish had left or had become independent. So then how that became also popular in the US, and then the more recent attempt to use Latinx to include LGBTQ plus people and trans individuals, and how with the population Latinos themselves that hasn't necessarily really caught up. So I guess it would be useful to accept that even for us Latinos, we is confusing, and it's hard for many people in the audience may be asking us to tell them what is the right way to call somebody. And I think it's probably important for us to say that it depends on the context, it depends on the preference, that there's not one right answer, but still there's something that brings us together, and we are grouped together, and as you said, we are an attack against one. Sometimes it's felt like an attack to others because of this categorization from outside. So I wonder if you can talk, Maria, a little bit about this idea of the no name and this kind of shifting identity that as your title uses, Latinos have gone through to the different decades.
It is an issue. It's a problem for us. I think, you know, there is the Hispanic Heritage Foundation, which does great work nationally for Hispanics and Latinos and Latinx, whatever you want to call us. And it has used that name proudly. And then there's the LULAC, which is the League of Latin American. So it's very, very clearly identifying by the Latin part. We've tried to categorize it by saying, well, in the West Coast or in the East Coast, but it ends up being really the media using Latino more than anybody else, than any other term. Hispanic used for generations now, for a very long time. and Latinx very recently, and only 2%, and many of the Latinos don't like the term Latinx. So, I mean, it sounds, it, even though it is a more inclusive term, as you say, and it is an effort by the part of, I think, mostly the intelligentsia of this country who are trying to be more inclusive. But it is a problem for us because what do you call yourself? Most people end up saying, well, I'm a Peruvian American or I'm a Mexican American. And that seems to be a solution for many. And but in the greater sense, when you talk about this body that people are now seeing as an electorate, as a group that's going to vote in a certain direction, I think that, you know, that's an impossible dream. The naming business has always been an issue for us.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
That is correct. Let me add my 2 cents by saying that in some of my work, I say that to avoid the gendered of Latino, Latina, that goes back to the Spanish gendered language, which again is not unique to Spanish, but to make it more gender inclusive, one could go back to this English word of Latin people as an adjective rather than claiming the name of a people. But still, that hasn't caught up, and that's not wrong. But so yeah, it's a shortcut for a creation of an identity that, as you say in the book, it was something maybe that Simón Bolívar, the great South American fighter for independence, had this idea of creating a larger Latin American nation that will encompass a lot of the independent countries in the global, in the south of the continent or throughout the region, that would bring all the descendants of the Spanish and the conquistadores and the indigenous people in the Latin American part of the continent. And that has not been a reality, but as you will say in the book, and I think this is correct, this dream of mixing of these different people from Spanish colonial and indigenous origins happening in the U.S. with the everyday interaction among Colombian, Peruvian, Mexican, Puerto Rican, etc., origin people, becoming neighbors, becoming friends, and sharing many things in common, Spanish, but many other traits. So there is indeed an Latino land that you document, and it's a very important trait. You were talking a little bit earlier about the geographical distribution of the different Latino groups. So can you please tell us, because a lot of people, I don't think, are aware of this, but can you please tell us about the importance of Latin American origin immigrants in the Washington metropolitan region, the DMV, as we call it?
Yes, absolutely. I want to say something to address something that you said earlier, which is important. You know, the extraordinary thing about Latin Americans and the Latino part of this hemisphere is that once the conquest happened, there was intermarriage. The mixing of races was extraordinary throughout the Latin American world. So many of us are a mix of ethnicities. We've intermarried with the African population, the slave population that came starting in the 1500s. We've intermarried with the Spaniards, with the indigenous, with the Chinese, with the Japanese, with the Moorish people, the Arabs who came. And the Jewish population, that we are such a mix. I think, having done my own DNA, I know that I'm a mix of all the things I've just mentioned are very much present in me. And Bolívar, as you so rightly said, understood this and understood that this mixing was actually historic It wasn't happening anywhere else in the world. This was an extraordinary part of who we are, is the race mixing. And coming to the United States and being Latinos in this country, we intermarry. We are the most, shall we say, the people who most intermarry with other ethnicities. There's no question about it. We have Latinos in the Northeast that are very much a part of the African culture. We have Latinos in the West who are very much a part of the Asian culture. We have, you know, a great Asian presence. And so that's really important to remember about us. In the metropolitan area of Washington, which you mentioned, and where I'm sitting right now, the presence of Latinos is huge. It's tremendous. And what I'm fascinated by in the Washington area is the whole villages that come from different parts of the Latin world. In the book, I describe a village from the Colca Valley in Peru, which almost came lock, stock, and barrel to Maryland and have a very strong community. They help each other. If somebody, one of them, there are thousands of them. There are at least, you know, 2,000, 3,000 of these villagers from Cabana Conde, the Colca Valley of Peru. And anybody gets in a car accident or has a health problem, and they all get together and raise money by cooking things and selling things and sewing things, and they help each other. And they are, by now, having been for three generations in Maryland, there are lawyers among them, there are doctors among them, there are people who have come from the village life in the mountains, really the Sierra of Peru, to create this whole world that in Maryland, which is extraordinary. And they're, you know, what, 15 miles from Washington, D.C., from the White House, from the Capitol, right here in the metropolitan area of the nation's capital.
Yes, that's right. And also the Bolivian community has been in the DMV for a while, and as you document in the book very well, a Central American population is kind of the backbone of the construction and service industry in the Washington DC area. Without them, we'll be having a hard time doing any renovations, buying any housing, buying any food. So it's not just people tend to think about California, Texas, Florida, New York, but there's Latinos in many places of the country, including in large numbers in the DMV. So thank you for that answer. You already touched upon it, but I think it's worth revisiting. In your book, you also talk about particular individuals of African origin who come to what is now the United States territory early on, before accompanying the pilgrims and others as slaves. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about these early Black immigrants that are part of these Spanish explorations.
Absolutely. Well, there is, you know, the very first Dominican who arrived in Manhattan was Juan Rodriguez, who was a Dominican Black. He was in the employ of the Dutch, and he came with, when the Dutch were in Manhattan, he came and was, I think, the first, I call him the first bodega, because he started to sell weapons and guns and what the Dutch needed for the fur trade, because they were all out hunting raccoons and whatnot for the fur trade in the world, which is at that point was a global market. And there was Juan Rodriguez in Manhattan with his bodega of guns and ammunition and knives and whatever was needed. And he was one of the first Latinos in this territory of the United States of America. So, and of course, there have been an enormous, people forget, I think, Professor, people forget that in the slave trade, which was 12 million Africans from Africa who were kidnapped and put on slave ships, and a million of them didn't make it across the ocean, the Atlantic slave trade, people forget that only 350,000 of them went to the United States. All the other millions went to Latin America. We are a very, very black community, Latin Americans, and a mix. You know, for instance, the Dominicans and the Puerto Ricans may not think of themselves as being black. They live on their islands, and you don't think you are a race until you get to this country. And here, where the binary is so important, where people are either black or white, suddenly here are the Latinos who are just every race of man. And you don't think of yourself as black, perhaps, if you come here as a Dominican or a Puerto Rican or, you know, someone from the Caribbean area of Venezuela or Colombia. And here you're made to reckon with that. And the black Americans who are here consider you more black than Latino. So that's an issue of identity as well that needs to be reckoned with when you come to this country as an immigrant.
Yes, yes. Many immigrants, they become racialized into the black-white binary as they cross the border, which, as you explain here and in the book, in Latin America, there's a rainbow and a mixture, and a lot of times people don't think in this black and white binary, and people are Peruvian, Mexican, Colombian, and in the U.S. there's a reshuffling of racial and ethnic identities from within and from without. A little bit earlier ago in this conversation, you were talking about the around 36 million people in the U.S. who can trace their origins back to Mexico. So that would be around 10% of the overall U.S. population. And an interesting report, a series of studies recently, were saying that looking at the listing of restaurants, they categorize that around 10% of all the restaurants in the United States are Mexican. So I'm using this example to say that there's a perfect representation there between the population and the number of restaurants. Obviously, not all the restaurants are quote-unquote authentic or owned by Mexicans, but the question is, can go on two ways, right? Does this show that now Mexican food is as American as pizza or hot dogs or sushi or hamburgers, all which have, or apple pie, right, which has the origin with the German immigrants, and now it's becoming just a staple of the overall, or whether we can say that while Mexicans have a rich, perfect representation proportionally in the food choices that Americans have, whether we see the same representation in Congress, in the Library of Congress, amongst authors, amongst all the jobs and the professions that could be had, whether we have reached that parity and in Latinos overall, or whether we're still underrepresented in all the different senses of the word.
That is an absolutely wonderful question, Professor. It gets to the heart of representation in this country. You are absolutely right. I was having a conversation with somebody at the Pew Research Center, which has done so much work in identifying us and describing us as a population and as different populations, who said, you know, the Mexican food is now American food. There, it just is. I mean, a taco, a burrito, a pupusa, all of these things are very much part of the American culture now. So much a part that it's almost like spaghetti or something. You know, it's American, and also it isn't realized. I had a Mexican say to me, you know, this is a person who is a CEO of a major corporation in Mexico with branches in the United States. He said, if we pulled Mexico out of the United States entirely, a lot of the culture and a lot of the industry in the United States would collapse. Absolutely collapse without the Mexican infusion that is already present. Proof positive is, for instance, bread. Bread in this country, the most basic food stuff. Most of the bread that's produced in this country is Mexican. people don't realize. You know, Wonder Bread, Arnold, Pepperidge Farm, Entenmann's, all of that is Mexican-owned and Mexican-produced. And not to mention, of course, the agriculture in this country, the food service in this country is so dominated by Latinos, Hispanics, who work in the industry and who produce. We are the breadbasket, really, of the country. So that, I think, alone makes us hugely a part of the way that the country works, the way that the economy works. We represent $3.4 trillion in purchasing power in this country every year, which is an enormous figure. It really is, and I write about this as well, it is, if you were to count the Latino population as consumers and producers, we would be just count us as a population, we would be the fifth largest country in the world. I mean, think about that. And yet, Professor, you're so right to make the point, and yet, we are not represented enough in the media. We are not represented enough at all in Hollywood. We're not represented enough in universities, in the teaching profession. The representation is not there. We are, and this is part of the problem of being invisible, that in the higher reaches of this country's, shall we say, management or where the American attention is, we're not there. And yet we are so much a part of the production and the consumption in this country. There are more people, it's the population that attends movies is so incredibly Hispanic, Latino, and yet they're not on the screen. So we have a lot of work to do in that department.
Unfortunately, that's correct, Marie. And your book is a contribution to try to fix these issues. A quick example, in the immigration lab here at American University, we just did a study where we showed that just the immigrants that send remittances abroad, which is not everybody, and it's not all Latinos, because many are US born, but just of the immigrants, a big number of them who are from Latin America, from the money they send home, we can then derive that around they are living in the US, they are producing for their employers over $2 trillion just in 2022. So yes, the economic impact is huge. The economic interaction and integration of Mexico and US is very hard to disentangle, and growing now that China has taken the second place of the largest trade partner with the US, Mexico being one, and is going to increase with other countries in the region. So yes, the Latino labor force, investment, brain power, etc., is a huge part of the U.S. present. In the book, you also document very well the long history and the historical contributions of this population. And you just mentioned a lot of examples about our present. Now, in the book, you also, and I think it's important for us to discuss now, the role that Latinos will have in the preservation of the country into the future, the role that Latinos will have in making sure that we have a U.S. future. So I wonder if you can please talk about that.
Absolutely. You know, we have such a long presence in the past that I think if we understood that, we would understand just in terms of numbers what we represent for the future. I think people don't realize that Latinos have participated in every war that the America has fought. I mean, we go back to the revolution. Latinos were a very necessary part of the revolution. George Washington at one point said we could not have won independence from the British had not the Spanish forces come up and helped. There were Latinos from the Caribbean all the way down to the mainland of South America that came up to fight in the wars of independence in this country, and right up through the Civil War, right up through the all the two world wars, the Korean War, all the way up, so that even today, the Marine Corps is 26% Latinos. So, you know, one in every four Marines is a Hispanic, is a Latino, which is an extraordinary thing that we don't realize. And it's not discussed, it's not talked about. But the military is, we are very, very present there. The if you project the representation that we have, not only in the military, but in the country, as in the cities, and now more and more in the center of the country, we have, I think, traditionally occupied the periphery of the coasts, you know, of the country. But now the Latino population, which moves according to the work that is offered in the country, is now very much a part of this heart of America, the American heartland. And I think people are realizing more and more that these are this is a community that has come into much, you know, there is probably no state, no territory in the United States of America that doesn't have Latinos working and living there. It has tremendous, I think, implications for the future of the country. If we're talking about being one in three come the year 2060, I mean, the population is going to grow just because we're a very young population. The average age of a Latino is in their 30s, whereas the average age of Anglo-Americans is in their 40s, late 40s. So we are a very young population. We reproduce large families. We are going to be here. We are part of the future. We are going to make, I think, a lot of the future paths that America carves will be carved by us. And I think that's a very important thing for especially those who govern us to understand. And those who, you know, are counting on us to, for instance, to be a swing vote in the elections or whatever, need to understand us better, need to understand that we are a diversity within a diversity. And this is very important for our future, Professor, a very important point to make. Thank you.
Thank you. And that's absolutely correct. There's beyond the obvious places, there's Latinos working, Latino families in Alaska, in Montana, etc. As you all mentioned, Marie, the U.S. population is aging. For the first time in history, probably in the last few years, the U.S. population has declined. And in the last 2 years, if it wasn't for international migration, the population will keep decreasing. So immigration from Latin America and other places is key for the U.S. economy to keep growing. But then there's two other questions that I think are related to this that I think are important for us to discuss. One of it is the fear, like what you said is correct, that we are the future, we're here, we're a growing numbers. The youth population is Latino, but that doesn't mean that, quote unquote, as some people say, there's a great replacement or a conspiracy theory to change America. U.S.-born Latinos speak Spanish like natives. U.S. Latinos keep American culture, institutions, politics alive. So I think it's something that will allow you to talk a little bit more about the quick assimilation, integration, Americanization of Latinos and how they become the backbone of the country, like other immigrant groups have in the past. So that on one hand. And in the other hand, as you were saying, the pounding from different groups that keep equating Latinos in the US as immigrants, first of all, which is not true. Over half the population have been born in the US and have been here for many generations, as you well say. But also this unfortunate discourse by some politicians and some media outlets that equate being Latino or being Hispanic to being undocumented, or even worse, illegal, right? Less than a person, being a defective, morally defective population. So what can you say that about this invisibility and exclusion by this recurrent trope of Latinos as newcomers, as you say, as immigrants, and therefore as illegal, and how that, and against the history you talk about, and also puts our future in peril? What would be your message to us about that?
Very important message. The trope that we are all immigrants is just simply false. And my book, if it does anything, I hope it dispels this notion, because the Hispanic population has been here, as I say very clearly, since the 1500s. It's completely documentable. A lot of it is neglected. I mean, people don't realize that the first admiral of the Navy, of the U.S. Navy, was David Farragut. And his name was Jaime Farragut, and he was a Latino. And this was the first admiral. You know, the entrenchment of Latinos sometimes is hidden, and we don't necessarily see it because it has been here for so long. It has been such a part of our presence as Americans. And I think that Latinos are, as I've just talked about being volunteering for the military, very strong sense of pride in being Americans and in participating in that culture. That notion of replacement is patently sort of ridiculous, because we've been here for a very long time. We are not replacing anybody. We are growing as any aspect of the population would, as the German Americans, the Irish Americans, the Anglo Americans have grown in their populations. Ours are commensurately growing with our numbers. And I think that the important thing to remember here is that as you say, the population is so necessary and so important to the working of the nation, to the productivity of the nation. That when you are a part, when you are a mechanism, you're a working part of the community of Americans in this country, the sense of loyalty that we bring to this country is very often neglected and very much there. If you've ever watched the citizenship ceremonies of newly arrived immigrants, it's extraordinarily moving, which I have seen many times now. The sense that you are here to work, you are here to contribute, you are here to be part of the American community and be a part of the American story going forward. I like to keep my eye on that.
Thank you, Marie. And the last question before we wrap up, can you tell us briefly about what are some of the risks that that we face as a society when some politicians from either party portrayed Latinos, new immigrants from Latin America and the Caribbean, as unwelcome, as invaders, as interlopers? What is the risk to creating violence, to excluding people that are well established in the U.S.? And what are the some people think that they may be having electoral benefits, although the data shows that is not the case. They are alienating a lot of other voters, and most Americans are pro-immigration, unlike politicians. So what will be your since we are in 2024 and electoral year, what would be your advice to people running campaigns in these coming months?
Very, very interesting, because I've just had a piece that is appearing in the Washington Post this week about this very subject, Professor. The assumption, I think, on the part of the Democratic Party, that because the assumption that we are all poor, the assumption that we are all helpless, that we are all new, and that we are in need of welfare, which is, even for the undocumented, It is not true. The undocumented are actually who are here, who are Latinos, are actually not a burden on the government. They pay taxes. They own homes. They even being undocumented doesn't mean you are taking from the U.S. government, not at all. And people have that misconception, but the assumption on the part of the Democratic Party, and this is something that the Democratic Party has to work on if it wants to keep its hold on Latinos, is that we are naturally Democrats because we want government, we want help, all of which is less and less true. The Republican Party has been very, very successful in recruiting, particularly in the Southwest, particularly in the South, the whole swath of the South of this country, has had a lot of success with Republicans. There has been also a great wave of Latinos moving into the evangelical community. They have there has been a great sort of exodus from Catholicism into the evangelical churches, the mega churches, and those mega churches are largely, of course, Republicans. They're conservative, and so the assumption that we are going to vote anyway is a false assumption, because this is a very diverse, politically diverse population. It changes. My parents, my father, when he came to this country, was a Republican. And with time, the whole, at the end of my mother's life, she was voting for Barack Obama. So, it's a very fluid population. We're likely to be more independents, really, in terms of the mindset than we are any party. We come from countries where the words conservative and liberal mean very different things. A liberal in some of our countries means, communist, a communist country. And there are people who have allergies to communism, as the Cubans do, because of the Castro Revolution. And so they are Republicans for that reason, or they tend to be Republicans for that reason. But, people don't often think of the trajectories of the Latino population, or the fact that just in the way that we cannot be categorized is in the binary of black and white, we can't be really categorized in terms of our politics as well. It's likely to shift. It's a very fluid situation.
Thank you, thank you. And as you say in your book, the Latinos, rather than being concerned about elite or highly sophisticated policy debates, they are interested in well-paying jobs, in access to education, in basic well-being, like any other American. So that's something that sometimes escapes some of the parties. Thank you very much, Marie, for answering my questions and engaging in this enlightening conversation. The book, again, is Latino Land, just coming out this 2024. It's a fantastic read. It's full of, we learn a lot about Marie and her family, a lot of personal stories, anecdotes, a lot of the conversations she had with the over 230 interviews she did for this book, beyond all the sources and the books and other materials that she consulted. So very well-researched book, very well-written book, very accessible, and very important to learn more about our U.S. society, which in part it's inhabited by this Latino community who are part of us, the United States of America. So congratulations, Marie, on this great accomplishment. I look forward to continuing the conversation in the future.
Thank you very much, Professor. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks for listening to this week's Afterwards podcast. If you are interested in podcasts about nonfiction books, listen to C-SPAN's Book Notes Plus podcast for interviews with authors and historians hosted by Brian Lamb.